It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The PNC Foundation plans to announce a $1.5 million two-year collaboration to help build young children's vocabulary and comprehension. It is working with other organizations, including Carnegie Science Center, Children's Museum of Pittsburgh, and the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, on behalf of Buzzword Pittsburgh, a family initiative in the city's Homewood neighborhood, to develop routines and habits that support language building. Pittsburgh is one of 10 cities PNC selected for this $10 million pilot program. And joining us to explain more about it is Sally McCready. She's president and chair of the PNC Foundation. Sally McCready, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Explain how this program works and what Buzzword Pittsburgh's aim is here to do within the communities.
Sure. So as you mentioned, we have a number of partners. We actually have six partners: the Carnegie Science Center, the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh, the Opera Theater of Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater. The Cultural Trust is our lead partner, and the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. And they're all working together, developing family programming that will happen in Homewood. So we have programs every other Saturday at the Homewood, at the Carnegie branch of the Homewood Library. And then we also have a series of six-week programs where families can come back time after time. And what the partners are really doing is encouraging families to learn new words, giving parents techniques for how to introduce new words at home, and having a lot of fun while they're doing it.
So you have all these organizations that are partnering with PNC on this. So how does it work? Well, give me an example of an exercise or an activity that you folks might be engaging these kids in that will help them build their vocabulary.
Sure. So on Saturday, the perfect example, we were at the Homewood Library, and we had the Opera Theater was actually leading the lesson, and they were introducing the word gigantic. And so through a musical telling of a story called The Sea Serpent and Me, Christina Farrell, who's a fabulous education person at the Opera Theater, led the families through the story, introduced the word gigantic through music and movement in a number of ways. At the same time, we also had the Carnegie Science Center there. They had a table where the kids could make gigantic puddles on the letter G. So they were introducing gigantic in a different way. They had little eyedroppers and they were making puddles on the letter G. And then we also had our Cultural Trust partner there, and the kids were making gigantic sea serpents. So they were reinforcing the words through a number of different activities, and that's really how children learn best.
And who brought this to your attention? How did you identify that there's a problem, that kids' vocabulary and language skills are lacking, and that we need to step in and do something?
Sure. There are a lot of studies that have long highlighted the importance of vocabulary in early childhood development. It really is a cornerstone of early childhood development, preparing children for school. And really, the best way to enhance children's vocabulary is just to talk to them, talk them through their everyday life, what we're doing all day. The more we talk, the more words they hear in context, the larger their vocabulary will be.
And how many children are currently participating in Buzzword?
Sure. We expect that there will be several hundred families that come through the program, whether it's the weeknight sessions or the Saturday sessions. And then we're also doing a number of events throughout Pittsburgh. So, for example, Buzzword Pittsburgh will be at the upcoming Children's International Festival that the Cultural Trust is sponsoring. And they'll be there doing programming for all of the families that come to the International Children's Festival.
So you're making it accessible to all children and families.
Right. We, you know, we have a targeted focus in Homewood, but we'll be at a number of events throughout the city of Pittsburgh so that we can have a larger reach with the program.
And is it making it fun that gets children interested in expanding their vocabulary? Because it's not always an easy thing to do. They're at a young age, so they're impressionable. But there's always that question of how you initiate it. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what you've done is to find as many fun and engaging activities as you can to get the kids to want to buy in.
Absolutely. And the parents, too. So I think you're absolutely right, Paul. Fun is the key here. And our partners have just done a fabulous job of working together to create really fun activities that the whole family can be engaged in and really focus and take advantage of kids' natural sense of curiosity.
And what will young students in communities like Homewood, and this seems to be, even though you're fanning this out, this is a target area that has been identified. So let's using Homewood as the example, what will young students eventually carry with them into adulthood as a result of this program?
So our hope is they're going to learn a lot of new words, which will enhance their vocabulary, which is shown to be an indicator of success in school, what your vocabulary is when you show up on the first day of kindergarten. But this program also relates to our Grow Up Great program, which is a $350 million program that we've been working on for the last 11 years. And the whole focus of that is to help kids be prepared for their first day of school, because studies show that kids that have high-quality early education are going to stay in school longer, are less likely to become teenage moms, will go to college, graduate on time, and come back and help their community.
And what is PNC hoping will come out of the investment?
Our overall hope is that all kids will have the opportunity to show up on their first day of kindergarten ready to learn, and everyone will be on an equal playing field on that first day of kindergarten.
How do you track this? Is there incremental measurements that you'll be looking at to see how effective this program is and how it's resonating not only with the parents but with the kids?
Sure. So we have an independent evaluator that's helping us look at the program, and really a lot of what is happening is she's going to the various events, she's talking to parents. So, for example, she was there on Saturday interviewing parents that have had an opportunity to attend a number of the events and really try to understand how the events are resonating. Are they taking some of the techniques and using them at home? And for us, that would be a huge win to take what they're learning at these different events and apply them at home in their everyday life.
And do you get the sense that the kids are having fun, that they are enjoying this?
It was, I would say, controlled chaos on Saturday. The families were having a ton of fun, and it was really great.
And what kind of feedback have you gotten from the families? What are the parents saying to you, particularly in a place like Homewood?
I think they were excited that all of these organizations are coming into the community. It was a great event for kids, and if you have little kids and you need something to do on Saturday morning, I think it was a lot of fun.
Do you find yourself saying, why didn't somebody think of this sooner?
I think for Grow Up Great, our whole program has been an evolution. For us, this is the first piece of our program, or the first grant initiative that we've done that didn't have a classroom component and that really focuses on family engagement. And I think it's an interesting direction for us, and so far it's been great.
And what's next?
For Buzzword?
Yes.
So we have a number of things coming up. The next program is at the Homewood Library on May 2nd. And it will be taught by the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater and co-led by the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, and they are introducing the word high. The next week, we'll be having the Carnegie Library again. The Children's Museum will be leading a session. And as I mentioned, we're really excited that Buzzword Pittsburgh will be at the International Children's Festival running May 14th through the 17th.
And there's always this thing you measure with kids, the cool factor. Are kids finding that it's cool to are they embracing language? Because sometimes kids think it's cool to use less words or to use slang, and that if you speak properly, that's not a cool thing. So how do you get past that?
Well, what's great about this age range is, you know, we're really working with 3 to 5 year olds, even younger, some older siblings.
Very open minds.
They think everything's cool at that age, so they really were having a lot of fun.
Sally McCready is president and chair of the PNC Foundation, and she joined us to talk about Buzzword, a family initiative, Buzzword Pittsburgh, a family initiative in the city's Homewood neighborhood to develop routines and habits that support language building. Again, Sally McCready, president and chair of the PNC Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the fall of Saigon was 40 years ago this week. We'll meet a Mount Lebanon native and Duquesne graduate, Stuart Harrington, who served as a military intelligence officer in Vietnam. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was 40 years ago this week that Vietnamese forces captured the South Vietnamese capital of Saigon, bringing an end to the Vietnam War. The occasion is being marked tonight on PBS's American Experience with the network television debut of the documentary Last Days in Vietnam, an Academy Award-nominated documentary about the chaotic final days of the Vietnam War. With a communist victory inevitable and the U.S. Army ready to withdraw, American diplomats and soldiers confronted a moral dilemma: either obey White House orders to evacuate only U.S. citizens or risk being charged with treason and save the lives of as many South Vietnamese citizens as they can. One of those facing that very dilemma was Mount Lebanon native and Duquesne University graduate Stuart Harrington, a retired U.S. Army colonel who served in Vietnam as a military counterintelligence officer and interrogator. He is the author of the book Peace with Honor and is one of those interviewed in Last Days in Vietnam. He joins us by phone from his home in Southern California. Stuart Harrington, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be at least partway home.
Right, here in spirit. And I should mention again your book, because it's Peace with Honor with a question mark. So it should read as Peace with Honor as you ask that question, and we'll explore some of the themes in your book as well as talk about the documentary. But let's begin by going back to late April 1975, with time running out and the city of Saigon under fire. Describe where you were, what you were doing, and the dilemma you faced.
I was stationed in Saigon as one of only about 75 American military who were permitted to be in Vietnam after the signing of the Paris Agreement in January 1973. I was actually there as a negotiator for the missing in action. We had a team that was set up by the Paris Agreement whereby the North Vietnamese Communists, the South Vietnamese Communists, the Republic of Vietnam, the TU government, and the American government met to discuss discovering information about the missing and the dead. So I was actually in Saigon performing that mission when everything began to crumble.
Is there any way to fully describe the chaos of the American departure?
Actually, I didn't think there was, although I gave it my best shot in my book. But this Rory Kennedy documentary goes a long way to showing the American people exactly what was going on as a 10-year commitment started to end badly and go south.
And Rory Kennedy is the person who produced this documentary and directed it. And how do you feel that it turned out? You're featured in this. You're interviewed extensively, and you were a part of this. After seeing it, do you feel that it tells the story?
Actually, I was mesmerized when I saw the final product. I mean, I had done a number of these over the years, including one with BBC Discovery Channel in 95 at the 20th anniversary. And some of them have been very, very good. Generally speaking, though, the mood and the tone was, look at this ugliness, look what American foreign policy failures have brought on to the Vietnamese. And I didn't think when I signed on to this project that there was room for another one like that. But she seemed to show me that she had a different concept and she was going to eschew the politics of the war and get to the situation where what do a handful of people do at the end when a moral obligation is felt to our South Vietnamese allies who stood up to fight at our urging. And she really did come through, a very, very talented, gifted documentarian, that Rory Kennedy.
So here you are in 1975 in Saigon as things are coming apart, and just describe the mood that you were in, what you were feeling personally as you were trying to save as many South Vietnamese as you could, and as you watched a situation crumble that you had been a part of trying to remedy for so many years.
Well, I was in my fourth year in Vietnam, including almost 2 years during the war out on the Cambodian border in a pretty exposed place, and had seen a lot of sacrifice, a lot of courage, and a lot of misery. I was a fan, a devotee of the South Vietnamese cause. It seemed to me, you know, having seen it up front, up close on the ground, that when we make the kinds of promises that we made to the South Vietnamese, that we really owe them our last full measure. And signing the Paris Agreement and saying, you know, sorry about that, the American public won't support it anymore, we changed our mind, goodbye, and oh, by the way, we're going to leave the North Vietnamese Army in South Vietnam, it was an extremely frustrating thing for me. So I guess the number one term that I would use to characterize that last 6 months as it became clear that the North Vietnamese were not going to take no for an answer was frustration and resentment. We were selling out an ally. It appeared like we were on a glide path to lose our first war. And all I could see was all of the Vietnamese with whom I'd worked over the years, their families, and what would happen to them having become associated with the Americans and the cause of resisting communism when the communists rolled into Saigon. So frustration, fear for the fate of our decent allies, and a little bit of anger because it appeared like the evacuation, as people began to talk of it, was for Americans only at the beginning.
And you said that you wept, that that as you were leaving, you cried, that there was this emotional reaction to what was going on.
Yes, I mean, the last evening on the 29th and the 30th, the morning of the 30th of April, you know, we were working valiantly to try and clear out about 2,000 Vietnamese and others who had crowded into the U.S. Embassy and voted with their feet. You know, they decided the embassy was the safe place to be, even though there was no plan to evacuate that many from the embassy. And we had worked, my bosses, Lieutenant Colonel Harry Summers, Colonel Jack Madison, we had worked for the better part of all day and all night organizing these folks and reassuring them that if they just settle down, throw away their suitcases, get into double lines, and stop pushing and shoving, that everyone would go and that we would leave at the end. So when the president called a halt to the evacuation, when we were shy of our clean sweep goal, because there were 420 Vietnamese and some South Koreans as well in the parking lot, you know, when that cessation, that sudden end to the evacuation was declared and that it was a presidential order, and the Marines told us that our little six-man team had to get out of there and leave these people behind, that was a point of, you know, that's the deepest of the depths of my time in Vietnam. And so when I finally did obey the order after questioning it and realizing finally that it was a done deal, and the chopper took off from the embassy, I looked down and saw those 420 people sitting in a disciplined group awaiting the helicopter that I had promised them would be coming. And I felt, a terrible, terrible sense of betrayal, of having basically these folks were put into the situation of being the last victims of American promises. We promised them we'd get them all out. We believed the promises when we made them. But, you know, in Washington, the fog of war intervened. The president didn't know, as he should have known, that the situation in the embassy was under control, that there was a limited number of people remaining. The result was that those people paid, and those of us who had given our word to them became the last Americans to betray South Vietnamese.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Mount Lebanon native and Duquesne University graduate Stuart Harrington, a retired U.S. Army colonel who served in Vietnam as a military counterintelligence officer and interrogator. He's the author of the book Peace with Honor and is one of those interviewed in Last Days in Vietnam, debuting tonight on PBS locally on Channel 13. Stuart Harrington, how did you end up in the military? How did you end up going to Vietnam?
Actually, I was commissioned through Army ROTC at Duquesne, but I was blessed to have won a federal fellowship, a National Defense Education Act fellowship, for 3 years of graduate study at the University of Florida. So in 1964, instead of going on active duty and being put into the pipeline to go to Vietnam, I went to the comforts of the campus, Gatorland and University of Florida, and I studied international relations, got a master's, finished my course in language work on a doctorate, and then eventually, 3 years had gone by. It was time to enter active duty. By a quirk, a strange quirk, even though all of us were on orders to Vietnam as soon as we went to Fort Benning, my orders were changed at the last minute, and I went to Germany. I had a German language capability, pretty rudimentary at the time, but they were looking for someone who spoke German, and I wound up as a spook, military intelligence type, doing spooky things in Berlin for a couple of years, until finally the Army said, it's your turn to go to Vietnam, get with it. And at that point in time, I was faced with the choice of staying or getting out of the Army. And Vietnam was not anybody's favorite place to go. And I actually got out of the Army. And part of the motivation was family. And part of it was that I really was a dove on the Vietnam thing. I thought, having studied it and studied the experience of the French, that this was probably a loser. And so I got out of the Army. Went back to Mount Lebanon. Took a job with Procter & Gamble. Hated it almost immediately, and within 6 months of leaving the Army, I was back, and the ticket of admission was to go to Vietnam. So I actually went backwards to Vietnam. I sort of backed into it. I told them I wanted to learn the language if I was going to go, and they sent me to an 8-week language school. And the next thing I knew, I was in Vietnam as an intelligence advisor to the Vietnamese militia on the Cambodian border in a pretty exposed place. And that's when I got to study the war from up close. And I learned that it was far different to philosophize about the history of a war and to form opinions in a seminar environment than it was to be on the ground. And realized very, very quickly that the South Vietnamese had a noble cause, that we had told them that we were with them all the way, and we owed them that. It was a solemn commitment. And I was seeing Vietnamese sacrifice, get wounded, killed, or otherwise suffer the travails of war because an American commitment had been made. And it didn't take me long before that commitment became my own personal commitment. And when the Viet Cong committed the atrocities that they did in my area, it was like they were invading Mount Lebanon to me. I took it very personally and became a fan of the Vietnamese and extended there and stayed as long as I could before the ceasefire was concluded.
You learned to speak Vietnamese, one of the few Americans to do so. How did you end up doing that, and why? Why was that important to you?
I had served in Germany, as I said, for a couple of years, and had gone to German language school in the Bavarian Alps, and learned very quickly that being able to speak and understand the language in a country was a major plus, without which, if you were living somewhere and you didn't understand the language, let alone the history and culture, you were sort of playing left out. And so having had the experience in Germany, I made my one condition about coming back on active duty and going to Vietnam that I get the language. And, of course, when I wound up in South Vietnam, out there in that assignment that I mentioned, it was invaluable because few of my counterparts spoke English. And if you really wanted to be effective, you had to be able to read captured documents. You had to be able to talk to prisoners. I made it my point to get to know the enemy one-on-one, meaning that when they had prisoners or defectors whom the South Vietnamese frequently didn't trust or dismissed as liars, I worked my own approach with them, treated them with dignity and respect, and it was amazing what I was able to learn. So the language to me, when you go to a place like Vietnam, or for that matter, you could substitute Afghanistan or Iraq, the language is vital. And that's one of our major weaknesses, that we go to a place, and as we look at this place and contemplate the decision to go to offer help, we don't really see, and we can't see because we don't usually know the history, the culture, or the language.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with Mount Lebanon native and Duquesne University graduate Stuart Harrington, a retired U.S. Army colonel who served two tours in Vietnam and was there during the fall of Saigon 40 years ago this Thursday in 1975. We can't take your phone calls today, but you can email a question to us at esspgh@wesa.fm, also on Twitter at esspgh. You served two tours in Vietnam. You volunteered to go back in 1973 after the Paris Peace Agreement was reached. Why did you do this? In your book, you quoted the assignments officer as saying anyone who would voluntarily return to Vietnam 12 months after leaving that hellhole must have been crazy.
You know, during the 12 months that I was back in the States at the Intelligence Center and school down in Arizona, I escorted Vietnamese officers who were there as exchange officers. And we lived and died for the news on Vietnam. And again, I was immersed in the justice of the cause. The fact that the people fighting for the cause, us and our South Vietnamese allies, frequently did so in a flawed fashion or just didn't have the kinds of success that we would like to have had, that had to do with the strategy and with decisions that were made at echelons way above us. But I was a very devoted fan of the cause, as said, and when it came time for there to be a ceasefire, I figured, well, that's it. I'm not going back there, even though I studied and learned that tricky language. But one fine day, they called me up and said, we got a problem. We've got an officer who's supposed to go over there, a captain. There's not room for many captains there, but this guy's having family problems, and we wonder if you might be willing to go back. And, you know, I thought to myself, would I be willing? Of course I'd be willing. And so I wound up on an aircraft in August of 73, exactly 12 months after I had departed, on my way back to what would, of course, turn out to be a sad and a bad ending.
And you said that you made an interesting observation in your book in which you said the Vietnamese, though they could never develop a genuine fondness for Americans, for we were Westerners, some of them exhibited a deep-seated psychological need for the physical presence of uniformed Americans. Explain this.
You know, the Vietnamese knew better than anyone, especially the Vietnamese military, but they knew better than anyone the strength and the determination, the resolve, and the wonderful supply situation that the communist enemy enjoyed. The North Vietnamese were always in the wings. If you fought the local Viet Cong forces and had a success, and you had a few of those successes, the South Vietnamese knew that the North Vietnamese could change the equation almost overnight by just crossing from Cambodia into that area, flooding it with North Vietnamese troops to bolster what they called sagging revolutionary morale. So the Vietnamese were acutely aware of how well-armed their enemy was. They were acutely aware of, you know, how determined their enemy was, and they honestly needed from us, even though it was their country and it was their mission to defend it, they desperately needed signs from us that we were constant, that we were with them all the way. And they were always frightened, and there was always a palpable nervousness about the American ally and about our constancy. Example is South Vietnamese soldiers would say to me, Captain, why is it that we have these weapons here? Some of them are old from Korean War, World War II, and the North Vietnamese have AKs and RPGs. Why don't we have weapons like that? And, you know, the implication was that these guys were wondering whether we were holding out on them. And when they captured the North Vietnamese weapons, the stuff was amazing hardware coming from all over the communist world. And it created a great insecurity. Then when the Paris Agreement was signed, of course, and we went home, in total, other than 50 to 75 of us, and the North Vietnamese kept 110 to 125,000 soldiers on the ground in South Vietnam, that really stoked the paranoia. In fact, it wasn't paranoia. It was a very real, grounded fear.
And did the North Vietnamese regard the Paris Agreement as a green light for unrestricted military preparations, and did that in fact create the path for the North Vietnamese to win the war? That's certainly something you seem to believe.
Well, the North Vietnamese were in desperate need of a pause. You know, the level of combat between, starting with the major campaign in Tet of 68, then the 72 offensive, and the final combat prior to the ceasefire, and the aerial attacks by our Air Force against North Vietnam had left the North Vietnamese, you know, pretty well wounded, and they needed a break. They certainly regarded the Paris Agreement as a strategic pause, you know, kind of a rouge, something that they could buy into to buy time to rebuild, but at no time did the North Vietnamese ever give up on the idea that they were going to conquer South Vietnam. Reunification of the country was their goal. They had two major allies were willing to underwrite them even after the ceasefire. They saw the American military leaving at the behest of American public opinion as soon as we got our prisoners back. They saw the Congress passing laws restricting the use of the American military, specifically in the Southeast Asian area. And, of course, they saw the Paris Agreement, where it looked to them, and I think they were correct, that, you know, President Nixon was looking for a way out of that war, and if they would give us back prisoners, they could basically get to gain their paws and prepare for the next phase of the war.
Ultimately, what can we learn from looking back 40 years ago at these final days in Vietnam that can apply today to what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, you know, the loss of South Vietnam was a terrible, blatant example of making a commitment and then not having the skill and the wherewithal to know how to approach realizing that commitment. I mean, we dragged our feet on figuring out the code on how to handle ourselves in that war for 4 or 5 years of wasted strategy that's beyond what we can talk about today. But basically, by the time we figured out that pacification and Vietnamization was the way to go, the American people had fallen out of love with the war. The Congress wasn't about to vote to support the war. And so our commitment, which we made, was frustrated by the fact that things didn't go the way we thought. You know, our military wasn't prepared for that kind of a challenge, and the South Vietnamese were certainly treated by us for about 4 or 5 years as not even junior partners in the endeavor. So as I cast my eyes about the world and about, you know, what's been happening, say, since 9/11, I say that the lesson learned from Vietnam should be look before you leap. And when I say look before you leap, that means that you have to look and really understand what you're seeing. What's the situation over there? What are our long or short-term prospects of achieving goals that we think we want to bring to these people? Because if you don't look before you leap, or if you look but you don't see because you're linguistically, historically, culturally biased, or because you're arrogant, for example, in Vietnam, we figured back in the mid-1960s, early 60s, the French screwed it up, but that's the French. And we certainly can go over there. We who've already, you know, defeated the Nazis, defeated the Japanese, we can go over there, and we're not the French. So, you know, the result was that we vastly underestimated the strength and determination of the enemy. We overestimated the strength and determination of the South Vietnamese, given the way we handled them. We certainly overestimated and misestimated the sense of the American people and, you know, what their patience levels would be for a longer war. And so, you know, since that's kind of the look, then we shouldn't be surprised that the leap winds up being a leap into a cauldron where there are forces at work that we just don't get, or which frustrate us and cause us finally to lose the support of the American people. So it sounds primitive and it sounds pretty elemental, but you know, the old thing that my dad used to teach me about, look before you leap, makes a lot of sense. We're much better at leaping than we are at looking.
My guest has been Mount Lebanon native and Duquesne University graduate Stuart Harrington. He is a retired U.S. Army colonel who served in Vietnam as a military counterintelligence officer and interrogator. He is the author of the book Peace with Honor and is one of those interviewed in Last Days in Vietnam, which debuts tonight on PBS's American Experience. You can see it tonight at 9 o'clock local time on Channel 13 here in Pittsburgh. Stuart Harrington, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
My great honor, Paul, and hello to Pittsburgh.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
Do not be fooled by Buffalo Drive, just outside South Park. There are no buffalo there. Instead, you'll find the park's 11 resident bison on a small turnoff marked Game Preserve.
You know, you have your usual suburbs, and here you got a park with great big animals in it.
John Doyle is South Park's naturalist. He and Gregory Hecker care for the herd.
You get attached. They're like big pets to me.
Doyle adds that, while largely harmless, the nearly one-ton animals are not pets.
They never lose that wild blood, that wildness in them. They might as well be out in the middle of nowhere on the plains.
But of course, they're not. They're in the middle of one of Allegheny County's 9 regional parks. Why? Joel Tarr is Caligari Professor of History and Policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He says area parks are indicative of the late 19th century urge to preserve land as natural space.
You have the idea that the nature should be untouched and people should be exposed to nature like that. So these folks really had a vision of nature that was almost pristine. On the other hand, the parks were particularly designed for the elite.
County Commissioner Edward Babcock seemed to have a foot in both camps. Despite describing the parks as the people's country clubs, with spaces for golf, tennis, and swimming, he pushed to reforest the former farmlands and stocked North and South Park with deer and, yes, bison.
There's a tension between levels of restoration.
The commissioners, by today's standards, took the restoration thing a little too far. In 1928, they hired families from the Blackfeet tribe in Montana as park caretakers. Though the families didn't stay, the bison did, growing to a herd size of 32 in the 1940s. In South Park's 7-acre pasture, one of the bison meanders into a patch of sunshine. It's like watching a Volkswagen Beetle take a stroll.
They eat a mix of grain, approximately, I believe, 100 pounds a day, 2 bales of hay, and a bucket of corn.
Park naturalist John Doyle says, at times, managing the herd can be all-consuming.
When we need to sell some, or get the veterinarian in, that's when it just seems like everything is buffalo, 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 buffalo. Right now, we need some new blood.
His efforts to keep the herd's bloodlines diverse is a familiar problem to conservationists who help protect the bison from being hunted to near extinction. More than 60 million bison once lived in North America. During an 1871 trip, Colonel R.I. Dodge calculated the herds traveling north past his wagon numbered 4 million, blotting out an area almost twice the size of present-day Allegheny County. Henry Kasperzik, a curator at the Pittsburgh Zoo, says by 1900, fewer than 1,000 animals survived.
It's kind of, nostalgic to me.
Kasperzik says the bison offer a chance to tell the good and bad of the American story.
Trying to, remind people of how close to extinction these animals came and the human impact that caused that. I want people to care.
Doyle does, too. But he's almost constantly engaged in buying and selling new animals to keep the herd healthy. And unfortunately, that market is made up mostly of ranchers.
I wish I was selling them to zoos, game preserves, but that's not the situation.
Doyle watches a bison scratch his back on the new grass and says he's heard of buffalo meat reaching prices of $30 a pound. I don't want to eat them, he says. I just want to look at them, you know? For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Since its passage, a number of advancements have been made to make life easier for those with temporary or permanent disabilities. This week, contributor Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looks at the latest innovations in crutches, wheelchairs, and walkers for people who are temporarily or permanently disabled. Rebecca Harris, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to be here with you, Paul, on this beautiful day. It's so lovely outside.
It is.
It is. It is. It's really nice.
Rebecca, you wanted to share some information and background on the Americans with Disabilities Act. So let's start there.
Okay. So we'll do a background on this. And this is an important year because it is the 25th anniversary. So basically the ADA prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, in transportation, public accommodations, communications, governmental activities. And the American with Disabilities Act is a law that was enacted in Congress in 1990, and Senator Tom Harkin authored the bill. And what was really interesting was when he actually delivered the speech, he did part of his introduction in sign language because his brother was deaf. And so he actually delivered part of it in sign language so his brother could understand. And it was signed into law on July 26, 1990. So we are in the 25th anniversary year, and July 26 would be the 25th anniversary. So the act basically affords similar protections against discrimination to Americans with disabilities as the Civil Rights Act of 1964 did. And basically that made discrimination based on race, religion, sex, national origin, and other characteristics illegal. But in addition, and unlike the Civil Rights Act, the ADA requires covered employers to provide reasonable accommodations to employees with disabilities and imposes accessibility requirements on public accommodations. So this is a really important act overall, both for people that have permanent disabilities and for people who have, you know, short-term disabilities, meaning they had an accident and they're recovering and they aren't at full capacity.
Well, like the Civil Rights Act and like the Voting Act, it's one of those pieces of legislation that you would have thought would have gotten done a lot sooner.
Wouldn't you think?
But I'm glad you mentioned Senator Harkin, because it was largely through his involvement that that it was brought to the Senate floor and eventually passed into law. He's a past guest on Essential Pittsburgh. We're going to invite him back for that 25th anniversary discussion.
Excellent.
In the meantime, as far as our discussion, to really understand the importance of innovation as it applies to this market, we need to look at the numbers. You are someone who always brings us those numbers.
Love those numbers.
So what are we looking at today, and why is innovation a national imperative?
Right. The reason, bottom line, is this is a huge market, And with the number of baby boomers and the increasing age, there it's becoming bigger and bigger. And so we need advanced technology now to really help people with either permanent or temporary disabilities. There's two measurements that are basically used. There's a measurement from the American Community Survey, AECS, and they estimate about 37 million Americans have a disability. And there's the other estimate that's looked at, and it's called the Survey of Income and Program Participation, SIPP, and they look at the number being closer to 56 million. And the SIP takes into effect a lot more disabling disabilities, such as upper body, mental health disabilities, as well as things like visual, hearing, cognitive, ambulatory. So either way you look at these numbers, these are tremendous numbers, Paul, and you can really see the need for innovative technology to advance and to continue.
And what is done, I guess, to keep track of whether all of these products, you're saying there are a lot of products out on the market.
Yeah.
What is done? Who scrutinizes the whether all of those products, first of all, the quality of the products, and whether all of those products are truly benefiting people with disabilities and, in fact, do what the producers of those products say they will do.
Right. I am sure that there is an approving body that has to actually license, and for medical reimbursements has to license them and licensure. Some things you can actually even just purchase online directly as a consumer. If you have medical reimbursements for certain things, I am sure that insurance companies are saying this one is approved, but this one is not approved. And as I've sort of scanned through the dearth of products available out there, and okay, in true disclosure format, we do have to say right now, I am on crutches. I had a fracture of my tibia, and so I've been on crutches for the last few weeks. And I have to tell you, looking at this from a first-person perspective changes your whole mindset on what people go through and how difficult it really is to navigate day-to-day living, and why it's so important that we have great innovative minds working on some of these projects and products.
And describe how that has enlightened your perspective.
Well,
or informed your your sense of how we adhere to the needs of the disabled from a commercial standpoint as well as an altruistic one.
Right. Well, what's really interesting is sometimes you'll go down a ramp, which is great because steps are very difficult, and then you'll get to a door that you want to open, but It says handicap accessible, but the door doesn't have an automatic opener. So you're trying to tug a huge, heavy door. You have two crutches, and it's impossible, Paul. It's truly impossible. Now, fortunately, I'm still able to sort of, you know, do it, but it's not easy. And so if you're dealing with that kind of thing every day, it makes it very difficult. Now, here's a great product I read about. It's called Connected Crutches. They're a redesigned crutch that alleviates pressure on the shoulders and arms and incorporates Bluetooth sensors, which allow a user to answer a cell phone easily, and it collects medical data. And those are the kinds of technologies now that are being invented. I read about a 3D printed prosthetic hand that incorporates sensors that allows users to control the level of force with which they activate the hand, and it also senses heat and cold.
Well, here's an example, and that's a prime example of how technology in the last 25 years since the ADA, how that has advanced greatly. By the way, the what you were trying to come up with was the Consumer Products Protection Division.
Right. Thank you very much. Yes. Yes. And so they'll really look at, because it's also very easy to put something up on the internet and you're like, I need that. And then you look and think, was that approved? Was it not approved? It might not even be safe at all.
Right. So before we move on, let me ask you this. Certainly nobody wants to experience a devastating injury if they can help it. That having been said, and that having happened to you, how much do you appreciate the perspective that you've gained on this? Obviously, you've expressed the frustrations that you've begun to understand more acutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when little things like, is there a ramp on a sidewalk? I mean, that's so important. Or if you are not handicapped, do not use handicapped facilities, because all of a sudden you just never know when a handicapped person might come up and really need them. And if you're using handicapped facilities, whether it's bathrooms or ramps or anything that really is meant for a specific purpose, you need to leave those available for the purpose that they were intended for. And when I've read about some of these other products, things like a hybrid walker with a folding seat and a caddy for cleaning products that can enable you to clean. I mean, the most difficult thing is you get really anxious because you can't do the things you normally do. So you begin to think about, well, what can I do to really enhance my ability to get things done, even though I'm moderately incapacitated? And mine is short term. So kudos to these people that are out there inventing all this great stuff.
And so two things we need to get to before we wrap up. We're talking with Rebecca Harris, our business contributor. Any other latest innovation technological products on the market today?
What I really also like are, here's a couple of things. Some scientists are designing robotic suits that increase the user's strength and mobility with braces and sensors. And that, what a great thing. So if your body is really weakened by whatever disease or fall or accident, this can really help strengthen you. I think that's very important. There are wheelchairs that are available now that you can use both on the beach and in the snow that have huge wide tires. So places that people could never access before are available. And I think those are very creative and very important.
And what's happening locally in this field?
Well, I think the FISA Foundation, which provides grants to nonprofit organizations in southwestern Pennsylvania that improve the lives of women, girls, and people with disabilities, they have a wealth of things on their website and activities. Pittsburgh and Allegheny County are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they'll be doing a lot of activities throughout the city and the county. And we have some things listed on your website, but there's lots of things going on.
And you can find out more about them by going to our website at WESA.FM. Rebecca Harris is the director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, and she's been here looking at the latest innovations that help people who are temporarily or permanently disabled. And Rebecca, we're glad it's just a temporary disability for
you. Yes, thank you. And I wish everybody out there just to keep inventing if you've got those ideas and celebrating this year.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's largest immigrant population is the Nepalese Bhutanese community. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll address how the community is coming together to aid the victims of their homeland in the wake of last weekend's devastating earthquake. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.